In the matter of Felix versus Richards, can we please have appearances of counsel? Good morning and welcome, counsel. Mr. Siegel, please go ahead.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of rebuttal, please.
We'll have you back, maybe for a little less. Please go ahead.
This case involves a single issue of law.
Try to keep your voice up. Thank you.
This case involves a single issue of law, whether New Jersey's Deamer statute, NJSA 17:28.1.4, operates to convert the bodily injury liability limits of a policy that GEICO issued to its insured in the state of Florida, Mrs. Felix, from $0 to the New Jersey standard automobile limit of $15,000 per person and $30,000 per accident. The trial court below held that the Deamer does apply, that GEICO owes a duty to defend and indemnify its insured up to that $15,000 limit, and that GEICO has a duty to reimburse all defense fees and costs incurred. The appellate division affirmed. It is respectfully submitted that both courts below erred, and under the circumstances presented before the court, the Deamer statute does not apply. It does not apply for two reasons. The first reason is a statutory construction and interpretation argument with respect to the Deamer. The Deamer requires an out-of-state insurer that does business in the state of New Jersey, in pertinent part, in the second sentence of the statute, to satisfy the liability limits, and in this case we're dealing with NJSA 39-6A-3. That section of the no-fault law sets forth the parameters of the standard automobile insurance policy. The very first sentence of 39-6A-3 states, except as provided by NJSA 39-6A-3.1. 3.1 sets forth the parameters of the basic automobile insurance policy. That policy does not require a New Jersey resident to purchase bodily injury liability coverage. It is not contested that a New Jersey resident who purchases a basic policy satisfies the requirements of NJSA 39-6A-3. Accordingly, it's GEICO's position that it has complied and satisfied the requirements of the Deamer. It issued a policy in Florida with $0 of bodily injury liability coverage, which is materially the same as a basic policy that satisfies Section 3. The GEICO policy here satisfies Section 3, and therefore it has complied with the Deamer statute. GEICO submits that to interpret the Deamer statute within the confines of the no-fault system any other way would be to discredit the legislature's enactment of the basic policy with the enactment of ACRA in 1998. Secondly, it is respectfully submitted that if this court chooses to adopt the appellate division and trial court's interpretation of the Deamer statute, and that advanced by AAA Mid-Atlantic, that such an interpretation would be a violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the United States Constitution. To be clear, GEICO does not take the position that, as written, the Deamer statute violates the Equal Protection Clause. GEICO's interpretation harmonizes the enactment of ACRA with the plain language of the Deamer statute. However, to the extent that this court does agree with the appellate division's interpretation, that interpretation as applied to GEICO to compel it to convert the bodily injury liability limits from zero to $15,000 and $30,000 would discriminate against GEICO as an out-of-state insurer because it would not bear any rational basis in furtherance of New Jersey's interest in the no-fault system to justify that disparate treatment of GEICO. In 2015, this court reached an important decision in Cure versus Perez, 223 New Jersey, 143. We quote at length in page 17 of our petition brief a passage from that case. And in pertinent part, that passage stands for the proposition that it would be both unjust and contrary to public policy to invalidate and disregard the legislature's advent of the basic policy, and to ignore that legislative development would undermine the purpose and practicality of this state's comprehensive statutory no-fault insurance system. It's GEICO's position that because it can lawfully issue a basic policy in the state of New Jersey, and that basic policy was created by the legislature in furthering the objectives of the no-fault system, that to have the court convert those limits from zero to 15,000 would undermine the enactment of the basic policy, and it would discriminate against GEICO without any rational basis in justifying that disparate treatment.
Counsel, is it your position that the Deamer statute, as interpreted by the courts below in this case, would impose a higher duty on out-of-state insureds to carry higher policy limits than in-state insureds because of the standard and basic policy differentiation here in New Jersey, which was not applied to the insured drivers and through them to insurance carrier, that the Deamer statute, as interpreted by the lower courts, impose a higher duty on out-of-state citizens and out-of-state companies than it does within state insureds and insurers?
Absolutely, Justice Fernandez-Vina. That's exactly GEICO's position, is that as an in-state insurer that is lawfully able to issue a basic policy in the state of New Jersey, and that basic policy, as held by this court in the Perez decision, furthers the objectives of the no-fault system.
And additional to equal protection argument, is there a Commerce Clause argument to be made here?
There is not. We at one point did have a Commerce Clause argument, but we are not advancing that any longer before this court.
Do you agree that you're covered under the second sentence of the Deamer statute? The interpretive question focuses on the second sentence of the Deamer statute. That's the one that governs your company that you're representing?
With respect to the issues in this case, yes. Justice Slovakia, that's what we are.
Okay,
discussing.
Then if so, what do you make of the fact that when the Deamer statute was amended, that sentence added specifically, it already had a reference to 39:6b-1, but the legislature added a specific underscoring of subsection A. They didn't have to do that, but they did. And that's the one that refers to the limits that you are seeking to avoid having being applied to your client. At the same time, they added the reference to the basic policy in the first sentence. So they clearly knew at the same time that they took those contemporaneous two actions how to distinguish between the requirements of the basic policy, excuse me, and the higher limits that are required under subsection A of 6B-1, as the Appellate Division pointed out.
Certainly, and that's an excellent question, Justice Slovakia. It is GEICO's position that the reference to specifically subsection A of 39:6b-1 is a carve-out with respect to motor vehicles. The Deamer statute in the no-fault law distinguishes between motor vehicles and automobiles. 39:6b-1 sets forth the standard policy limits for a motor vehicle. A motor vehicle is defined under the no-fault law as it is excluding private passenger automobiles. This case is dealing with a private passenger automobile, and therefore 39:6b-1 does not apply. We instead look to 39:6a-3. And with respect to the fact that the Deamer statute in the first sentence references 3.1, that reference is in the context of discussing when a out-of-state insurer must provide PIP benefits to a New Jersey resident that is not eligible for those benefits.
So following up on what Justice Slovakia is asking you, let's look at this. We should try to construe the plain language of the statute, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so it has two sentences, correct?
Yes.
And the first sentence deals with PIP, correct?
Yeah, and the second sentence does as well, but yes.
The second sentence also deals with liability
yes.
coverage. So In the first sentence of the Deamer statute, it specifically provides 39.6A-3.1, right? Not 3, 3.1. So the legislature knew how to distinguish between just referring to 39.6A-3 and 39.6A-3.1, correct?
Yes.
Because in sentence 1, they refer to the basic policy for PIP, and in sentence number 2, with respect to 39.6A-3, they refer to the standard policy with respect to liability coverage, correct?
Yes.
And in the second sentence, if the legislature wanted to specifically reference the basic policy as it did in sentence 1, it could have mentioned 3.1. It did not do so, correct?
That is correct, Justice.
So my question to you now is, why should we import something into this statute that the legislature specifically omitted?
It's respectfully submitted that the legislature did not omit 3.1 because when ACRA was enacted in 1998, the first sentence of section 39.6A-3 was amended. It was changed to add a reference to section 3.1. It is our position that the legislature did incorporate by reference 3.1 by the citation to 6A3 and the fact that a New Jersey resident that purchases a basic policy satisfies the requirements of 6A3.
If your interpretation is correct, there was no need for the legislature in sentence number 1 to reference 3.1 because you're saying that it's automatically referenced by 39.6A3, correct?
That's not entirely our position. The reference to...
But if I accept your argument, any reference to 6A3 automatically brings in 3.1, no? Are you not arguing that?
Yes, we are arguing
that. So that's where I'm having difficulty, because in sentence number 1, they specifically referenced 3.1, and then they decide not to when it comes to liability insurance. Thus, 6A3, they could have added 3.1, did not do that. And that's the statute before us. Like, why should we not read the language as it is plainly written?
It's our position that the language as plainly written does incorporate 3.1, and to ignore that the advent of the basic policy is to contradict this court's holding in Cure versus Perez, where this court specifically held that the advent of the basic policy furthered legislative goals of enacting the no-fault system. In particular, the 1972 adoption of the no-fault system had three goals: to reduce minor personal injury claims in court, to reduce auto insurance premiums, and to arrange for the prompt payment of first-party benefits without regard to fault. The enactment of the basic policy does check all those boxes and advances what the legislature
it does, the basic and the special policy, was an effort by the legislature to draw in the poorest, the indigent citizens into the insurance market, so we wouldn't have people riding on our highways and byways without liability insurance. I don't think that the legislature is really promoting the basic or special policies, because it's leaving victims without an insurance company from which to seek remuneration from their injuries. So one of the questions is, do you know percentage-wise how many basic and special policies are issued compared to standard? Is a basic and special just a small percentage of the market? Do we know from this record?
That information, Justice Alvin, is not within the record. However, I'm confident that amicus NJ Cure will be able to address that question.
Mr. Okay. Siegel, your argument rests largely, as I understand it, on the language of 39.6A-3, which is incorporated by reference in the second sentence. If I understood you correctly, you're saying there's an exception carved out at the beginning of 6A-3, and because it's cross-referenced, that applies in the Deamer statute. Do I have that right?
That's correct, Chief Justice.
So step back for a moment. Assume you have two statutes. The first statute is incorporated by reference in the second statute. Then, afterward, there is an amendment to the first statute, but no change to the language of the second statute. The incorporation by reference, does it include the later change, or do you look at what the language was at the time the cross-reference was adopted by the legislature?
I think that's an excellent question, Chief Justice. It would certainly depend on the specifics of what the amendment to the first statute was and whether that affected the plain language of the second statute.
I think just take the hypo that I gave you. You have language that is incorporated. It's later amended, but the legislature does not touch the part of the second statute that has the cross-reference. Are you saying the legislature has changed the second statute even though it did nothing with respect to it?
If the second statute is incorporated by reference into the first, I think that would be a fair characterization, depending on the circumstances.
So not the facts of this case. Assume it's a definitional section. And some important language is defined in Statute 1 and incorporated into Statute 2. And then later, there's a material change in the definition. Which definition applies if there's been no change to that cross-referenced piece in the second statute? Do you go with the definition at the time the legislature made the cross-reference, or do you go with something that happened years later when the legislature didn't adjust Statute 2?
I believe the principles of statutory interpretation advanced by this court suggest that the more specific definition should govern, or the more specific statute should govern.
Shouldn't we look to what the legislature intended in its enactment and look at the time that it enacted a statute to see what it meant?
Certainly. And under these circumstances, the legislature purposely made an enactment a change to offer the basic policy.
So let's go to this point here. The original Deamer statute from 1985 includes a reference to 39-6A-3. Correct?
Yes, correct.
And at that time, there was no carve-out for a basic policy because none existed.
Right.
Then you have the first change to the Deamer statute, and you have the 1997 amendment that goes into effect at the beginning of 1998, which leaves the cross-reference as it existed in this original statute, as 39-6A-3. It doesn't say as updated, it doesn't incorporate a different version, it doesn't touch that, correct?
Correct.
So why wouldn't we look at the first definition that was incorporated? Why is it appropriate to look at a revised exception for the basic policy if the Deamer statute wasn't amended in that respect? You follow my question?
Absolutely, Chief Justice.
Please, help us.
And again, I think it comes back to the fact that the legislature engaged in a substantial public policy shift when it did create the basic policy, and it's GEICO's position that as read, all of the statutes must be read together and harmonized if there is any conflict or tension between them. And here, the reference to 39-6A-3 and the carve-out to the basic policy that was made through the legislative change to 39-6A-3, it is our position that must be adopted and incorporated into the Deamer statute.
So the logical extension of your argument, if I understand it, is if 6A3 is changed a year from now and the legislature doesn't do anything to the Deamer statute will have changed because one of the statutes cross-referenced changed.
I think that is fair to say, Chief Justice.
Even though the legislature that passed the Deamer statute never contemplated that meaning for the Deamer statute.
It's our position that they did contemplate that cross-reference. And the reason that is because if the Deamer does apply here to convert the bodily injury limits from zero to 15,000, it comes back to the equal protection argument. And the fact that GEICO can lawfully issue a policy with $0 of bodily injury liability coverage in New Jersey, GEICO can lawfully issue the same exact policy in Florida.
It's a very fair argument to raise. Tell us, when was that first raised in the litigation here?
The equal protection argument was first raised at the trial court.
And the Commerce Clause, you're no longer advancing. You're saying, was that previously raised at the trial court, the appellate level?
That was first raised in the appellate level, and we are not pursuing that argument any longer.
Okay.
So that's where the percentage of basic policies and standard policies. I don't know what it is because there's nothing, at least in the record before us. If the number of basic policies was a very, very small fraction of the total number of policies issued, and the vast, vast majority are standard, would that affect your equal protection argument?
I don't believe it would affect it whatsoever, Justice Alvin, because the fact remains that GEICO can lawfully issue the same policy in both states. And this court held in Perez that the enactment and advancement of the basic policy furthered the legislative goals of the no-fault system. And to discriminate against GEICO as an out-of-state insurer in a way that bears no rational relation towards achieving this state's goals in the no-fault system cannot be justified. And that's why there would be an equal protection violation regardless of the percentage of policies issued in the state.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, one of the original purposes of no-fault was to make certain that drivers had liability insurance to protect innocent victims of accidents on the roadways. And when you get to the basic and special policies, they can provide zero protection to innocent victims.
And
right?
That's correct. And if I may add to that, Justice Alvin, changing the facts of our case slightly and assuming that Ms. Felix was a New Jersey basic policy holder, there's no dispute that GEICO would have no duty to defend or indemnify her in a lawsuit. And instead, Richards would have a viable UIM claim against his own insurer, AAA Mid-Atlantic. And so there are provisions in place to address exactly those situations. And that was a development of the no-fault law from when it was enacted in 1972.
Assume that your statutory interpretation is not correct, but your equal protection argument is valid. What does this court do?
I believe this court would have to invalidate that section of the Deamer that would require an out-of-state insurer to increase its bodily injury liability limits from zero to 15,000.
Other questions?
No.
Anything else you'd like to add, Mr. Siegel?
I think that's all for now, Chief Justice. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Poe.
Morning, Your Honors. It's a privilege to be here. My name is Eric Poe on behalf of Cure Auto Insurance. I'm not only the attorney for Cure, but I'm also an officer at Cure Auto Insurance. Cure was founded about 30 years ago as a New Jersey-founded insurance reciprocal, and it also is domiciled in the state of New Jersey. So you might find it surprising that we're actually here on behalf of the out-of-state insurance carrier and arguing the position of GEICO. But we're here because we are hoping to respectfully urge this court to revisit its position that it took and its holding in Cure versus Perez about 4 years ago. We hope the court takes this opportunity in order to create a uniform bright line rule as to what the recognized minimum compulsory insurance laws are in this state in a post-ACRA 1998 environment. Now, I don't want to be redundant, so I'm not going to rehash any of the statutory interpretation, the heavy workload that my colleague here, Mr. Siegel, had to deal with. That homework I left to him, and I also don't want to address the Equal Protection Clause arguments because that's also, I think he did a very formidable job in arguing that. But I am here to raise two distinct issues to the court. One of them is really how we got here and how we believe courts have struggled with trying to determine what is the minimum compulsory insurance laws in this state in a post-ACRA environment 21 years later. And also, number two, to address my fellow amici, the NJAJ, and the arguments that they submitted in their brief. And I'd like to start with the second point first, only because I think it's easier to address and simpler to conceptualize. The NJAJ has articulated to this court and tried to persuade them to believe that any decision this court makes today will threaten somehow the resources of the UCJF. Now, that is completely misplaced for two fundamental reasons. Number one, going back to Justice Alvin's question about how many policies are actually basic policies or special policies in the state of New Jersey, I don't have that in the record. I will gladly supplement it before this court, but I can tell you that from my last reference to it 2 weeks ago, there are 31,000-plus basic policies in the state of New Jersey, which is actually larger than CURE Auto Insurance is, and there's over 60,000 special policies in the state of New Jersey out of 5.7 million vehicles, which means that roughly, you know, the math might be off here, but less than 2% of the market actually buys a special or basic policy which contains no uninsured motorist coverage. Now, why is that important? Because if the NJAJ is trying to posit to this court that there is some influence materially to the UCJF, it's absolutely misguiding this court to believe that there's no uninsured motorist coverage in 98% of the policies sold in the state of New Jersey. So if this court were to believe that the Deamer statute yields that the compulsory insurance laws are zero and an out-of-state insurance carrier is not obligated to pay anything, the car accident they would be involved in with an in-state driver in the state of New Jersey 98% of the time would have uninsured motorist coverage and deem the UCJF completely legally ineligible, okay? The second reason why it's a misplace is because the UCJF is a cash-based assessment fund funded not by taxpayers but by insurance carriers. So based upon your size, every year the UCJF pays out whatever it pays, let's call it $1 million hypothetically, and every year it goes to every insurance carrier based on its written premiums and says, based upon your size, you owe 1%, 5%, 10% of whatever this bill is. It is legally and factually impossible for the UCJF to run out of its resources unless every single insurance carrier does not exist in the state of New Jersey. So now that I got off that off my chest, I'd like
so
to
let me get something off my chest.
Okay.
You may not be able to help on this. I know that you want to avoid the equal protection argument, but thank you for the statistic. If only 2% of in-state motorists have either special or basic, would the state be violating the equal protection clause of treating out-of-state drivers the way it treats 98% of in-state drivers?
I believe so, Your Honor, because it is the choice of a consumer to make that choice of having a basic policy. There's no eligibility requirement. So simply because maybe agents don't tell them about the basic policy or because rates are more expensive, basic policies, believe it or not, in the state of New Jersey than standard policies, it doesn't mean that the out-of-state citizen or carrier is not being discriminated against from an in-state carrier. Hopefully that addresses that. Now, going to the substantive part of our argument here today, I want to talk about really why I think the courts have had a judicial struggle with what is the minimum compulsory insurance laws in the state since 1998. And primarily, I think it's because the legislature created this misnomer or belief that this basic policy is anything different from a standard policy. The only difference between a basic policy and a standard policy is simply the new choices that it offers. Typically in our industry, when we have different policies...
I hate to interrupt you.
Sure.
But this is a case of statutory interpretation. So I'm trying to figure out, like, how are you, if you can tell me how this is advancing the first part of our challenge, which is to interpret the statute.
It doesn't really address it, except for that if you were to defer in terms of like this gray area of statutory interpretation, I'd like to take a step back as to why I think the courts have struggled judicially with trying to arrive at what is the minimum compulsory insurance laws. And so it's more of a persuasive argument as to the broader picture of what's happening in this state as a result of this struggle since 1998. Your Honor, normally in our industry, we have policies that differ based on different perils that we cover, whether or not it's a D&O policy or an E&O policy, an HO5 policy or an HO3 policy. It determines whether your replacement costs or actual stated value. These types of things are distinguishable in policies. The only thing the legislature did in 1998 is say that this is a basic policy by providing an alternate to the minimum that was less than the current minimum. Your Honors, logic would dictate that any time, and I argued this 4 years ago, any time that there's an alternate to the minimum that is lower than the minimum, it must be the new minimum. And any time you deviate from that logic, we come up with these varying gaps in how much protection we're going to give innocent third parties, or in this case, innocent third parties dealing with an out-of-state insurance.
You're making a policy argument. I understand that, and I appreciate it. But I'm trying to figure out how is that educating us about answering the issue before us. You're a friend of the court.
Yes.
Can you help us with the interpretation of the statute?
Your Honor, I don't want to delve into that, so you're right. Okay. So I won't touch further into my persuasive argument from a policy perspective as to how you should interpret this, I guess, false dichotomy is what I would call it. And if you do have to err on the side of understanding the broader picture of this, our position on this is simple, that if this court believes, and we believe that the support is there, that the Deamer statute should yield that an out-of-state insurance carrier is only required to provide what the minimum compulsory requirements are of liability in the state, which is zero, that we believe that it should revisit its position in Cure versus Perez, because it would not make logical sense to require an in-state insurance carrier that's been defrauded in an application for insurance to provide more coverage than an out-of-state insurance carrier that is required to cover nothing in terms of that liability.
Understood.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Chief. Mr. Kaplan.
Thank you.
May it please the court. We begin our argument by focusing upon the core principle that was stated in Proformance versus Jones and in other appellate and Supreme Court matters, and that is our comprehensive insurance scheme of mandatory automobile insurance evinces a strong legislative policy of providing funding for people who are injured by tortfeasor motorists. Now, that comprehensive system is comprised of several statutes: the compulsory insurance law, the UCJF law, the Unsatisfied Claim and Judgment Fund law, the Automobile Insurance Cost Reduction Act, and Title 17, Chapter 28, which has various commandments regarding mandatory insurance, and includes what has become known as the Deamer Act. All of those laws have a common motif, and that is protection for the injured motorist, and at the same time, preserve the fund of the Unsatisfied Claim and Judgment Fund. GEICO challenges this core principle, saying, notwithstanding the fact that the Deamer statute specifically says that the standard policy limits, 15 over 30, are to be furnished to the motorists coming in from out of state. They say that that standard should be replaced by New Jersey's basic policy. And what I would refer this court to, and I know you're already aware of this, is the legislature's statement in NJSA 39:6A-1.1, where the purpose of the amendments were stated, including why the basic policy was created in 1998. It was something that Justice Albin alluded to, for lower-income New Jersey residents as a lower-cost option to provide medical expenses for auto accident victims. There's nothing in the legislature statement that refers to providing benefits to carriers who fall within the ambit of the statute in relation to the Deamer statute.
Isn't everyone insured so that the benefit comes through the carrier? Your argument seems to suggest that it's the insureds themselves who are paying for the any monies due. It comes from the carriers. So your argument that the legislature, and I recognize that that was a legislative intent to provide basic policy so people couldn't afford the standard policy to pay, but wouldn't that argument apply also to the out-of-state policies so that if someone's from out-of-state, they should be entitled to have that type of policy and so they can afford it also, just like the New Jersey legislature wanted?
Your Honor, I can only speak to the history of New Jersey's no-fault law, the Automobile Insurance Cost Reduction Act, the compulsory insurance law.
But doesn't your argument fly in the face of the fact that the out-of-state carriers should be entitled to the same protections for the out-of-state insurers that New Jersey insurers have, so they also can afford policies. And if it's raised by the Deamer statute here in New Jersey, doesn't that create an imbalance?
Well, not at all, Your Honor, because, first of all, I don't know the history of Florida's No-Fault Act and what their premiums are based upon and what warnings they receive. We know from reading NJM versus Varjabedian that before somebody in New Jersey, and that court, which was a published appellate division decision.
I'm familiar, very familiar with it.
Of course, Your Honor.
Very familiar with it.
Yes. And what they determined was that this disfavored type policy, hey, we're getting extra people into the pool, but at the same time, anybody who signs up for it has to read in 12-point type warnings that their assets are at risk. So we would rely upon the reasoning from that court, which I know Your Honor is more than well aware of.
Mr. Kaplan, we're trying to interpret the Deamer statute, and
yes,
the second sentence in particular. Tell us what specifically in the language of the statute you're relying on to make your case.
Well, we rely upon the methodology outlined in our by the appellate division panelists in this case. They meticulously dissected sentence one and sentence two. They looked to the ordinary meaning, as did the motion judge, who carefully tracked the language of the Deamer Act in comparison with the facts of the case. And specifically, what I think is very helpful is to look to the wording of the statute. The Deamer statute commands that insurers within its ambit are required to furnish certain liability coverage. And in the Deamer Act, it's designated you must furnish your insurers with the equivalent of what is NJSA 39:6B-1, subsection A. And then they use the term or. And in this instance, or means the equivalent of what, and then they go on to say in the Deamer statute, NJSA 39:6A-3. And the reason why we say that by using the word or is an equivalency, if we look in sentence one of the Deamer Act, and when the legislature is saying that PIP benefits must be provided pursuant to NJSA 39:6A-4, or, they use the word or, meaning the equivalent of pedestrian PIP, NJSA 17:28-1.3. So the language used by the legislature is very consistent. And by utilizing the term shall, it means that they must provide bodily injury, property damage, uninsured motorists, and standard PIP coverage. Now, GEICO concedes that before 1998, they would have been compelled to provide their insurers, to whom they sell policies out of state, they would have been compelled to provide bodily injury coverage under what was then the standard policy levels, 15 over 30. This issue has been decided in the appellate division about 14 years ago, and everybody's been operating under that understanding ever since, with the case of Cooper Hospital versus Prudential, where the court termed the issue at the outset of the opinion whether the 1998 amendment to New Jersey's Deamer statute, NJSA 17:28-1.4, limits an insurer's obligations. And the court went on to explicitly and specifically hold that carriers like GEICO in this case, quote, were required to provide PIP, liability, and UM coverage to non-New Jersey residents covered by the policy as well as to New Jersey residents.
So let me ask, assume your interpretation is correct. Assume that Florida has a system of no-fault similar to our own and that they offer basic and special policies, and a Florida resident purchases a basic policy that has no liability coverage, now comes into New Jersey and is involved in an accident. Your adversary is saying to not treat the out-of-state resident the same way an in-state resident would be treated violates the Equal Protection Clause. What do you say about that?
What I say about that is that the Deamer statute is not directed to people. It's directed to insurance carriers within its ambit. And GEICO, who is an admitted and authorized carrier in New Jersey, understands that. They've been to the courts of New Jersey on several occasions on issues dealing with the Deamer statute, and however they figure their premium base and their premium rates must have or should have contemplated that if you come into New Jersey, you're going to have to furnish your insured, based upon the existing law from our appellate division, a published division decision in Cooper Hospital versus Prudential.
Wouldn't that cause them to raise their premiums to out-of-state residents in Florida on off chance that they might come through New Jersey on the turnpike? And if so, wouldn't that affect their policy of providing more insurance for people who cannot afford it, just like New Jersey? Because all they're doing, they're actuaries, and they're deciding what the risks are, and that's how you establish the premiums. So if they take into account that a driver from Florida may well come into New Jersey so that they may have a higher coverage, wouldn't that affect the premiums in the Florida policy and create a problem there, similar to our problem here?
Nothing in this record demonstrates that GEICO has calculated what a difference in premium was or should have been. What we do know is that in GEICO versus Allstate, which even preceded Cooper Hospital versus Prudential, GEICO was fully aware of the provisions of the Deamer statute. And
as it was then written.
Right.
Not the new Deamer statute.
And the Deamer statute.
What we hear about today.
And the Deamer statute is for the benefit not only of the injured motorist, it's also for the benefit of the tortfeasor motorist.
Let's imagine that 1.4 read as follows. New Jersey insurers don't have to provide bodily injury coverage. Florida insurers, or any other state outside of New Jersey, must provide a bare minimum of 1530. Would that raise an equal protection clause problem?
I don't know, because our statutes have been vetted both in the federal court and in our state courts for decades, and as they existed. And now
has that question been vetted?
No, but...
So vet it with us now.
Okay, all right. If you have a carrier like GEICO who does a significant amount of business in New Jersey, they fall within the ambit of the statute. And the legislature has made a policy decision. And if you have, if the Florida policy issued by GEICO would be construed to be equivalent to New Jersey's basic policy, well, we know that this basic policy is not an uninsured vehicle, because in the Title 17, Chapter 28, by definition, a vehicle covered by the basic policy is, by definition, not an uninsured vehicle. Now that vehicle becomes an underinsured vehicle. And as we all know, uninsured motorist coverage in New Jersey is an option. So if somebody doesn't select underinsured coverage, or if it's not advertised so that to make it attractive to people, or if the rates are made higher, what we're doing is we're directing those accident victims to the unsatisfied claim and judgment fund. This is something that
I'm not sure this goes to the equal protection.
Pardon me?
I'm not sure the answer squarely addresses the equal protection clause concern. Can you help us with that?
Well, the only help that I can provide is that since our courts have determined that the Deamer statute passes the reasonable basis test, which is the standard test for this type of issue, the rational basis test. Since it does, has been reviewed in that regard, and our courts have uniformly said it passes constitutional muster, we're no longer involved with the problem.
Taylor, for example, did that in the context of saying the verbal threshold applied across the board to all. Has this kind of differential been justified? What is the rational basis for treating out-of-state insurance companies in a more onerous way, obligating them to provide coverage that New Jersey companies do not?
That's why I have a problem with terming a company like GEICO as an out-of-state company. They have a significant, it's not part of the proofs in this, I'm just watching the ads on TV. You have a significant number of GEICO insureds. I understand they have a significant market share. Why should they be characterized as an out-of-state insurer? Maybe they have a home base in Delaware, but they do a lot of business in New Jersey.
But that's not the equal protection test. It's a Florida policy and a Florida insured. I'm trying to wrap my head around the fact that you're saying it's the Florida insurance company that is the key to our equal protection determination and not the Florida driver, number one. Maybe you could explain that to me. And number two, your whole argument completely ignore the fact that the statute was amended to include 3.1? That it says except as provided in 3.1? What meaning or import does that amendment have if we adopt your logic? Those are my two questions.
Right. 3.1 is included in NJSA 39:6A-3.
Right.
Saying you're not going to be considered uninsured if you've selected the basic policy. So that's in response to your question about whether the exception is incorporated into the Deamer Act. It certainly isn't incorporated into the Deamer Act. The other question concerns whether or not the Florida motorist is the one that's not obtaining equal protection. They're obtaining
Well, not just
protection.
The Florida motorist, but the Florida insurance policy. You're saying the test is whether they do business in New Jersey and should be considered to understand our insurance law. You're saying that for that reason, equal protection isn't implicated. And I'm suggesting, where in the world is that the test of equal protection?
Since the Deamer Act is addressed directly to carriers who do business outside of the state, but also either do business here or are affiliated with a carrier doing business here, that they fall within, in the statute's term, within that statute's ambit. So
that's true of all liability insurance across the board, not limited to auto insurance. You're suggesting that that rule somehow applies to an equal protection analysis across the board? Because that's what we have to decide.
I'm only addressing the Deamer statute, which addresses...
I got you, but you're suggesting there is an equal protection test for the Deamer statute that is, I think, different from the equal protection test for any other matter, insurance or not, before this court.
I didn't mean it to be understood. Maybe it was inartfully
phrased. Maybe I just don't understand.
Our point is that since GEICO falls in the statute, I don't mean to repeat myself, but falls within the ambit.
I got your point.
Let me ask the question a different way. In Whitaker, when the Deamer statute was upheld on equal protection attack, the state had to come forward with an explanation, not that there was an elimination of all inequality, but that there was a rational basis for the decisions that the legislature had made in imposing the Deamer requirement on riders of insurance whose cars then come into New Jersey and have accidents here. And the focus on that analysis was on the impact the Deamer statute had on protecting the assets of the UCJF. Now, how does that analysis, if anything, change now that we have the existence, as your adversaries are arguing, of policies that don't include the old bodily injury 1530 liability requirement?
In our view, the same principles that governed and motivated the legislature in 1972, in the amendments in 1998, It all goes back to the core principle that we avert to at the outset. And we're going to make the analogy to other instances where this same core principle applies, and that's where a policy is voided for some reason. Mm-hmm. After all, in Performance versus Jones, wasn't there a totally valid business use exclusion? And based upon the core principle and our compulsory insurance law, it was determined by this court.
So what rational basis is being advanced here by us interpreting the Deamer statute the way you are asking us to interpret it? What is the rational basis that is advanced by the legislature that avoids an equal protection problem here?
That the same principles that somebody coming into the state, Ms. Felix in this instance, she was injured. Mm-hmm. She should be entitled to New Jersey PIP. She should be entitled to liability protection, protecting her up to the first $15,000 of any claim asserted by Mr. Richards, saving the court perhaps from a liability trial.
But more importantly, perhaps in this instance, saving that potential claim from being turned over to the UCJF, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
In a strange way, this Deamer statute provides greater protection to an out-of-state motorist than an in-state motorist. So if you have a Florida resident who buys a basic policy in Florida, and he or she comes into New Jersey, it now becomes a standard policy. They have liability insurance, mm-hmm. and their assets actually receive greater protection than a New Jersey motorist. Are you following me?
Yeah, absolutely, and with the same argument I think was made in Performance versus Jones, here we have a totally valid business use exclusion. Why do we have to pay one penny of indemnity to the injured party? And yet it was this court's position that based on our compulsory insurance law and the core principle that we started out with, that there has to be a fund to pay that injured victim.
Well, what we don't know, and this was touched on by Justice Fernandez-Vina, is if GEICO and other insurance companies understand that their out-of-state residents who are purchasing basic policies are going to have them converted into standard policies when they're traveling New Jersey, will that affect their premiums? And will that affect their premiums in a way that they won't be able to purchase a basic policy in Florida? Are you following me?
I do, but we have no proofs concerned. That'd be rather for us at this point to make a speculative argument.
Can we go back to the language of the statute and the very first question of the two that Justice Solomon asked? The second sentence of the Deamer statute says you need coverage that will satisfy the requirements of 6B-1A, which requires bodily injury coverage, or 6A-3, which Mr. Siegel argues has an exception for the basic policy right at the outset. Why isn't 6A-3 satisfied here?
That's why we brought up the point of the term or, meaning the equivalent of.
So or, well, sometimes when you have a list of statutes, they may be equivalent, and you can satisfy this one or that one. Sometimes they may not be equivalent. The word or, are you suggesting, is a determination of equivalence as a general rule?
Not as a general rule, but within this statute, because as we pointed out previously, when in sentence one the legislature designated the type of PIP benefits that have to be afforded to New Jersey residents, they say in accordance with NJSA 39:6A-4, or, and then go on to reference the pedestrian PIP statute, which provides precisely the same benefit.
So let's use the plain meaning of the word or and tell us how you prevail under the statute. Let's not assume that it means what it links happen to be the same, but or means or. You got to satisfy both ends.
Yes, and the reason why the plain language should prevail here is that if the legislature meant for the basic policy to be incorporated into sentence two, it's 39:6B-1B is conspicuously absent from the Deamer statute.
So you prevail on that one.
Pardon me?
So you have a good argument as to the first statute, 6B-1A. How do you prevail? How has the coverage not satisfied the requirement of 6A-3?
Because if the legislature meant for the basic policy to be part of the Deamer statute, they would have said NJSA 39:6A-3.1, which is the basic policy. That also is conspicuously absent.
No, 6A dash, I thought 6A-3 reads differently.
6A-3 sets forth the standard levels. 39:6A-3.1 is the basic
policy. Let me rephrase. They certainly could have said it that way. They did not include 3.1 specifically. They do have a reference to 6A-3. Why is that not satisfied? Because 6A-3 at the outset contains an exception.
I'll rely upon what the appellate division panel said in this case. Essentially, I'm saying this is in substance what they said, is the basic policy is an exception. The standard policy is the rule. And that you don't raise the exception over the rule and make the exception the rule.
I have one other question on rational basis. You started out by explaining that our compulsory system of automobile insurance is designed to provide coverage for the injured, correct?
Yes, sir.
I think that's pretty much a quote. At some point, the legislature must have concluded that protection of the injured certainly required PIP, but didn't require liability insurance, BI, personal injury coverage, for some segment of the population. In other words, it was more important as a policy decision to enable people who can't afford the insurance to be able to drive than provide that coverage for the injured motorist. I mean, at some point that happened, right? Isn't that the decision they made? I'm just asking.
The way I view the basic policy is from the guidance given to me by the legislature when they made their findings in 1997, and when it was enacted in 1998, they said that the purpose of the basic policy was to provide medical insurance, get people into the pool so that their automobile accident-related injuries would be paid for by a measure of PIP benefits.
And
that's where I derive my understanding.
Did they not also discuss the need to enable some segment of the population who could not afford to drive, the ability to drive?
I think overall that's why they wanted them to come into the pool.
Okay, so I'm just suggesting that at some point the legislature decided the need to protect the injured motorist through personal injury, through bodily injury liability coverage was, and the effect that this would have on the UCJF was not as important as making sure people could drive. In other words, they exposed the UCJF by allowing motorists to have this mini policy. They made a conscious decision that the impact on the UCJF is not overriding, correct?
Yes.
All right. How does that square with your argument now that somehow it is overriding or at least provides the justification for imposing this liability on out-of-state drivers and out-of-state insurance companies? I understand you don't qualify, you don't suggest GEICO's an out-of-state insurance company, but no. Let me just, the out-of-state motorist who's insured by a company, how does that square?
I think it all reverts back to the core principle that you have some policy's intention. The policy's intention or intention, T-E-N-S-I-O-N, are compulsory insurance to make sure that innocent accident victims get some recompense as compared to somebody's selection of a basic policy.
Does that recompense include that liability insurance, that BI insurance?
Yes.
Okay. Now, didn't they decide when they amended it, when they added 3.1, we're letting people drive without that protection? It's not as important as other considerations. Isn't that something they said, and how does that square with the rational basis test.
The legislature made a determination that if you fall within the scope of its coverage, you as an out-of-state insurer are going to have to provide that coverage. It's a policy decision.
And what the appellate division said, and I think you're wrapping yourself in their argument, they said all insurers are being treated equally by having that obligation imposed on them in the minimum amount of 1530. It's the insureds who are given the option to purchase more or less. But the insurers and the analysis of the appellate division is focused, as it was in Whitaker, on how insurers are being treated vis-a-vis one another is the same. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Except in this particular situation, out-of-state insurers are not given that option because whatever they purchase, when they come to New Jersey, it'll be a 1530 standard policy. So those insureds are not being given that option when they come to New Jersey.
Yes, the person who buys that type of coverage in some out-of-state location, I don't know whether or not they get the choice at New Jersey.
Well, they would not if they came to New Jersey, because under your interpretation, they would be bound by a standard policy and not the basic policy in New Jersey, so they're not given that choice. If they plan on traveling anywhere other than outside the state where they purchase the insurance and come to New Jersey, they're not given the choice that a New Jersey insured has of purchasing a basic as opposed to a standard policy. Because they automatically are deemed, under your interpretation, to have this standard policy.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
But the question is, from the equal protection analysis, are we looking at insured to insured, or are we looking at insurers to insurers? And I think the analysis is insurer to insurer, correct?
Yes.
And if that's the analysis, your argument is all these people are operating in New Jersey, bound by our law, and all being treated the same.
Yes.
Correct.
Not being treated the same as New Jersey citizens, though, because they don't have that choice.
Well,
and it also could affect their premiums and purchase insurance in the other state, because if those carriers, knowing full well that people travel interstate with our magnificent interstate highways, and they raise the premiums, that would affect those that the legislature sought, reduce the cost of making coverage affordable for individuals with limited income. Those individuals with limited income in other states would not benefit from that if they travel through New Jersey. So they may not be able to purchase policies in that state.
We don't know that, because we don't even know if you have a countrywide company, whether or not it would raise anybody's rate appreciably because of the extensive pool of people.
New Jersey has a pretty extensive pool, and it raised the premiums considerably here. That's why they went to the basic policy, correct?
And the person gets...
Can I assume that the countrywide, it's bigger pool than the New Jersey pool?
And the person gets a significant warning.
How do we... I'm just having a little trouble wrapping myself around this, Nick. It's the clash between what Justice Lavecchia is saying and what Justice Fernandez-Fina is saying. The person who drives in Florida probably had a choice, chose zero liability coverage. Okay, the insurance company, we don't know what they said to him, but they presumably could have offered him and did offer him a lot more at more expense. But everybody agreed, and they chose zero. They come to New Jersey, and now they, even though they didn't choose it, even though they didn't contract for it, are required, are given more coverage and required to pay more. Whereas in New Jersey, that same negotiation results in zero coverage, zero personal, zero liability coverage, and they only pay zero. I'm having trouble wrapping around how that doesn't, my head around, how that does not violate equal protection.
Well, our legislature created this public policy. Right. It's their public policy.
Yeah, I thought, okay. I got you.
Can I ask a question? Is your equal protection analysis going to differ if you have an insurer who writes only in New Jersey as compared to others who write all throughout the country?
I'm addressing the issue as to the Deamer statute, which is addressing carriers who write policies out of state.
Right.
Without regard to whether they even... I don't know if there are any carriers that do not write in New Jersey. I know there are certain kinds of liability insurance you can't get in New Jersey, but if there's an auto insurance carrier that writes in Montana and Nebraska, but not in New Jersey, is that different? Does that not comport with your
analysis? That, now you're talking about the classification of that insurer and whether they fall within, in the statute's terms, within its ambit. Yeah. So
you're saying they would not.
Are there companies that write only in New Jersey?
I don't know.
Because to say that the Deamer statute covers other states doesn't answer the question as to whether there is different treatment.
If a carrier writes a policy out of state and they are affiliated or do business here, now they're the...
I understand that, and that's why I was asking the question whether there is a category of carriers that only writes in state policies. To contrast with the example that you're offering.
That I don't know.
No.
The Deamer statute is designed to address the out-of-state policy vehicle that comes into New Jersey and has an accident here. It's a specific issue that the legislature was addressing, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
My last hypothetical, and this is a concern that you hear from Justice Fernandez Vina, and assume that you have a Florida citizen, New Jersey citizen, both purchase basic policies for $1,000. As a result of our Deamer statute, which is going to convert the basic policy into a standard policy, when that Florida citizen drives into New Jersey, is going to require GEICO or some other insurance company to increase the premiums to, let's say, $1,500, an amount that the Florida citizen can no longer afford, so that the New Jersey citizen can get the basic policy for $1,000. The Florida citizen is now having imposed upon him or her an increase, perhaps beyond the ability of that person to afford the policy. If there were such facts, would that create an equal protection problem?
It might, but we don't know what warnings or what warnings were provided to that motorist who is purchasing that policy. New Jersey ensures that that person is going to know full well that their personal assets are at risk. Even currently, I don't know that anybody can represent what the state of the Florida legislature is in terms of its revisions of its Motor Vehicle Act and insurance law.
How would a warning, if the person can't afford it, what good would a warning be? The warning that is given in New Jersey that your personal assets could be at stake, that coverage will be limited. If you can't afford it, no amount of warning is going to be able to make you afford the policy. So regardless of what the warnings in the policy, Florida policy are, if it raises the premium and a person can't afford it, the end result is the same. The warning has no cause and effect on whether you can afford a policy or not. That's a cause and effect of your job, your finances.
So then we don't know in this instance, and in fact it's relatively doubtful based upon the declarations page, that the policy obtained by Ms. Felix in Florida was equivalent to New Jersey's basic. We know that the property damage level of coverage wasn't equivalent. We don't know how to compare the premiums between New Jersey's basic and what she paid in Florida. So I don't know that we can make some equivalency. All I know is that our legislature has determined to impose the requirements of the Deamer Act, and that the Act has been considered by federal courts and this high court and appellate division as a passing constitutional muster.
Thank you, Mr. Kemp.
Thank you.
Mr. Molinari.
Thank you. Good morning, Justices. It's been a long morning already on this topic. I'll try not to take up a lot of time. I know we only have 5 minutes anyway. Some of you who have been on this court for a long time might be looking at me saying, why does NJAJ care? Right? Because normally NJAJ appears before you, and a lot of people think that we only care if there's money to be made somewhere or that we always have our own interests. I'm here today because there was a case in Hudson County 3 years ago Very similar set of facts, except my client in that case did not have a policy of her own. So I sued both the UCJF and I sued GEICO. And these same arguments were presented to a trial judge in Hudson County, and that Hudson County judge sided with GEICO and said they don't have to provide 1530 standard policy coverage. I turned to my client and I said, I believe that that judge is wrong. I would like to appeal it. However, the UCJF is willing to tender their $15,000 policy limits now. So you could have $15,000, or you can come with me on this trip through the appellate division and let's see where we go. And guess what? No matter where we go, we're coming back to the $15,000. So I had no choice that day, but I honored my client's wishes and we accepted the $15,000. But that troubled me. When I read Mr. Kaplan's case, I called NJAJ and I said, you know what, I would like to have the opportunity to argue amicus because I think that there are trial judges who got this wrong and now there's an appellate division judge who finally got it right and I would like to address those issues before the Supreme Court. As amicus counsel points out, I did argue the UCJF statute and the reason that UCJF wants to protect the Supreme Court and the legislature has said we need to protect the assets of the UCJF. So why is that relevant? I have no reason to doubt the statistics that were given to us by counsel. So maybe there's 5.6 million insurance policies in the state of New Jersey. Well, how many people don't have insurance in the state of New Jersey? Because where are we now? In 2019, we've become largely a commuter state. Up where my office is in Hudson County, so many of the residents of Hoboken, Jersey City, they live there because they commute into the city and they don't need to own a car. And the same could be true to the southern part of the state. If you're that close to Philadelphia, you don't need to own a car. So if you don't have, you're not one of those 5.6 million insureds, what's your only alternative in a case like this? Your only alternative is the unsatisfied claim and judgment fund as administered by the New Jersey PLEGA, the Property Liability Insurance Guarantee Association. So is that why I'm here today? Yes, because I think it's fundamentally unfair that we're taxing that system. Because at the end of the day, the GEICO policy that's written in Florida, and I don't think that's a secret here, and I don't think any counsel will deny, GEICO is the number one writer of insurance auto insurance policies in the state of New Jersey. Their underwriters know very well, it's been the law for 20 years, that if that vehicle comes into the state of New Jersey, there's a claim that's going to be made that the standard policy applies. Is there a slight addition to the premium? Probably so. On the other hand, if the unsatisfied claim and judgment fund has to bear the burden of paying these claims, well, counsel says the insurance company, each one is taxed. Well, where's that money come from? Every one of us should look at our auto insurance policies because the last charge on that policy is a surcharge payable to the to fund New Jersey PLEGA. So everyone in this courtroom who has an auto insurance policy is paying a few extra dollars. I'm not saying that it's going to break the bank. I'm not saying you can't have your cup of coffee in the morning because of that $2, $3, $4, $5, $6. But I'm saying we all pay something toward that fund. GEICO has made a conscious decision. They want to write in Florida. They want to write in New Jersey. Well, their premium is going to be slightly higher under that very small chance that that driver may come into New Jersey with that vehicle. Justice Fernandez-Vina, you asked a good question.
That's the only one I've ever asked, by the way.
Usually when someone tells you it's a good question, that's because they don't have an answer for it right away. But I had the benefit of sitting there for quite a while. And I also have the benefit of doing personal injury work for 30-plus years. And there are a number of carriers who only write down south, because this isn't just in Florida. This is down in the Carolinas. They just don't have mandatory liability insurance. There's a number of carriers down there who only write down there.
Are there any that only write up here?
You know, I heard that, and I don't know the answer to that. I was trying to think off the top of my head, because what do we see? We always see the bigger ones, right? Because that's the ones that come across our desk on a regular basis. I don't know the answer to that. Okay. But if someone down in Florida wants to buy the policy with no coverage, there are plenty of other people they could buy it from other than GEICO who don't write in New Jersey. And if GEICO's policy then became so restrictive because there was an added premium to it, they would go to the other one. And so there is no equal protection argument. The equal protection argument, as correctly pointed out by you, Your Honor, was specifically addressed in Whitaker. And then Whitaker was before ACRA. So the reality is that anybody, if you want to do business in New Jersey, you understand that this is part of the cost of doing business, and you pass it along to that consumer. And if that made your business in New Jersey not profitable, you don't have to write here. You could stay in Florida, you could stay in other states, but New Jersey specifically enacted this to protect its citizens.
Can I ask you one question? Forgive my ignorance.
You may.
Two basic policy holders are involved in an accident. They're both injured. Is the UCJF implicated in that case?
Two people who have chosen not to have
liability insurance.
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, so it's not as stupid a question as I thought it was. Because I assumed the answer is no. They're
well,
not
statistically, as you heard, there's only 30,000 basic policies. So the likelihood of an accident
I think it was
between,
90, wasn't it?
No, it was 90, which was a combination, and this is really interesting. The combination was 60,000 special policies,
right.
30,000 basic policies. Okay. So there's no argument today that it should be 90,000 policies considered because 60 of those are special, which means they're only available to Medicare recipients. Right? So we can't say they're available to everyone. So now we're down to the 30,000 people in the entire state. If a collision occurred between two basic policy holders, I don't know the answer to that question, to be honest with you.
Anything else you'd like to add?
Other than I would ask Your Honors to protect the resources of the Unsatisfied Claim and Judgment Fund and to affirm the decision of the Appellate Division, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Siegel, brief rebuttal.
Thank you, and I will try to keep my remarks here brief, Chief Justice. I wanted to just pick up Chief Justice, with the question that you asked to Mr. Kaplan about why, under these circumstances, is 39.6A3 not satisfied? The answer to that question is it is satisfied. A basic policy under New Jersey satisfies a resident's obligation under 6A3. GEICO did issue a policy that is materially indistinguishable from a basic policy. And the declaration page at DA40 of the record outlines the coverages provided in this GEICO policy. It is materially indistinguishable. Both offer zero. The GEICO policy, therefore, does satisfy the requirements of the Deamer statute because it does comply with 6A3. Justice Solomon's comments and remarks about this tension between the application of the basic policy and converting it to 1530, and how does that reconcile with a equal protection argument, I think the answer to that question is the Deamer cannot be read in a way that invalidates the basic policy. And that was at the heart of this court's decision in Cure versus Perez. And Justice LaVecchia, with respect to Whitaker and the other cases that dealt with the equal protection argument, the rationale applied by this court and the appellate division was that requiring an out-of-state insurer to provide PIP benefits and requiring an out-of-state insured to satisfy the verbal threshold, those are two of the pillars of the no-fault system, and therefore those courts found that there was a rational basis to hold the out-of-state insurer and the out-of-state insured to a different standard. It did not discriminate against those insurers and the insurers without a rational basis. It's respectfully submitted that this is different. Bodily injury liability coverage is a third-party benefit And to Justice Solomon's point, when the legislature enacted the basic policy, it did consider the implications of that and what would happen if a tortfeasor had a basic policy and there was no liability coverage for an injured third party or an innocent third party victim. All of those things were considered by the legislature. And based on this court's holding in Cure versus Perez, it's respectfully submitted that the basic policy, just like PIP, just like the verbal threshold, does advance the legitimate interests of this state in the no-fault system. And there's been some suggestion that because GEICO is a large auto insurer, it should not benefit from the protections of the United States Constitution. We reject that argument. We suggest that GEICO is entitled to the protections of the Equal Protection Clause. And to hold GEICO to a higher standard than it is held to in this state does not justify, there is no rational basis to justify that disparate treatment.
Thank you, counsel. And thank you to all counsel for the helpful arguments. We'll take a brief recess and return for State versus Isaiah Bell.